You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splash!
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. We took a week off last week, but we're back again to bring you more incredible Royals coverage. I, of course, am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me is the unfatigued by the All-Star break, or should I say rejuvenated by the All-Star break, Michael Engel. Mike, how's it going?
Let's go with rejuvenated, I guess. It was like our own little All-Star break for this show. So, I mean, we've been doing this pretty much weekly since spring training. So, I mean,
yeah.
I think we're due a break.
You know, everyone's due one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, we just fill out the paperwork and hand it in and see if it gets approved. And there it was.
So,
sure.
But speaking of breaks, we're currently now in the All-Star break for all of Major League Baseball. The All-Star game was last night. The American League won. Greg Holland pitched a scoreless seventh inning, struck out one batter. Salvador Perez started the game. I don't know. It's one of those weird, like, Matt Cassel makes the Pro Bowl type things where, like, Sal Perez definitely deserved to be in the All-Star game. But the only reason he didn't start was because Matt Wieters was hurt. However, there's definitely an argument to be made out there that he should have started anyway.
Yeah.
And I think that is not outside the realm of reasonable opinions. But anyway, he started, went 0 for 1, and Alex Gordon obviously did not play because he's trying to rehab his right wrist, which was having some problems. Hopefully, skipping the All-Star game, giving that a nice little rest, definitely made him on the track to be healthy so that he can come back on Friday when play resumes. But before we get to that in that series with Boston to kick off the second half, let's do a recap of the first half, shall we?
Let's do it.
I don't know if we're going to go – we're not going
to – I don't think we need to go month by month.
Yeah, but or in like the whole grade players, each player type of thing. But just kind of an overview, if you will. I mean, if you listen to this show, you probably follow them close enough that we don't necessarily need to rehash everything. But we will talk about some things that just jumped out at us as we take a step back and kind of look at what the Royals accomplished in the first half of the season. I mean, the biggest thing that you can look at and say, if we're talking just on the positive side of the scale here, the biggest thing you can look at and say this is great is the Royals are over 500 at the All-Star break for the first time since 2003, I think. So over 10 years. And now you're in a position where they're only, let's see, they're two games over 500. They're 6.5 games back. And I believe they're 2.5 games out of the All-Star, or I'm sorry, out of the wild card. So they're not in a bad spot right now. It could definitely be a lot better, and it would have been a lot better if they would have won more than just one out of four games against the Tigers right before the break on a four-game series. But can't do anything about that now. They're 6.5 games back, and they won more games than they did last year at the All-Star break. 8 games better, as a matter of fact. And they are, last year, they came out of the gates firing on all cylinders coming out of the All-Star break. And they were the second best team in all of Major League Baseball for the second half of the season. And they played roughly 23 games over 500, I believe, if I remember correctly. It was 47 and 24 or something the second half of the season, something like that.
43 and 27 in the second half.
Okay, 16 games. Okay, so I had the numbers reversed on that one. But yeah, pretty good. And if they were to do the same thing now, they would be in pretty good. If they go 16 games over 500 in the second half, it puts them at 18 games. Let's see. What is that? 92 and 74.
They're 48-46 now. So that would be 42-26. So that would give them 90 wins.
Okay. There you go. And so, last year it was 91 to get in the playoffs. Was that what you thought? 92?
92 were the wild cards.
92 wins for the wild cards.
Though I don't, I mean, this year it seems like
there's down this year.
Yeah, it seems like the middle teams are kind of bunched in there a little bit more, and so that could be something where, you know, those 90 wins might do it. I think 92 is what you want to shoot for, just because that's kind of, you know, 92 wins did it last year. 93 was the year before. And then 2011, 91 wins got in there. So I think asking 90 to do it is kind of tough. But they do have the second wild card. And so, you know, you're just kind of looking for Seattle to kind of falter. And, you know, they've been playing well, but they don't seem like they're for real. Their pitching's for real. Their offense is pretty sketchy. That sounds pretty familiar. But their defense isn't nearly as good as Kansas City's. And I kind of feel like they've overachieved a bit, but I haven't looked that deeply at their players, whereas Kansas City's players, I've focused on them for years now. So, I could be missing. I could have a blind spot for sure. I freely admit that. But, I mean, you know, it was a decent first half. They had the 10-game winning streak. Pretty poor play. Early May, they started off pretty bad. And this stretch, they limped in again. I mean, it's every year they have a problem finishing the first half. I don't know what that says about the players or Ned Yost or if it says anything, but it was pretty frustrating there to go in and lose, you know, three games against Detroit at home, trying to close it out. And even like going into the seventh, they were down 2-0. They'd scored like 4 runs total all series. They had been behind all but like 6 innings where they'd been tied. So, I mean, they were just thoroughly dominated again by Detroit in Kansas City. So I was, you know, pretty rough. I mean, if they had lost, they'd have finished the gone into the break at 500, which I don't think that's the plan. So
it's this weird new reality almost for the Royals, at least reality of the last 2 years, you know, or last year and this year, and that so many times over the last 20 years, probably, how many times have we in this town, or, you know, obviously we haven't been doing the podcast for that long, but since we've been doing the podcast, try and say, okay, this is the most important Royals baseball series in X number of years or X decades even, you know, and this year it seems like every time we turn around, this is the most important, this is the most important, this is the most important. And, you know, it was, we talked about it on this show a few weeks ago, every time the Royals are on that precipice, you know, where they can, you know, either make the leap and get to the other side or just fall flat on their face, you know, more times than not, 9 out of 10 times, or 99 out of 100 times more likely, they fall flat on their face. And this year, you know, they had the one time where, you know, they get into the 10-game winning streak and they took hold of it. They didn't fall flat on their face. They went back and got into first place, and then they kind of faltered a little bit, but we're still hanging around. And then they had another one of those step forward moments, those turning points against the Tigers right before the break, laid an egg. You know, that is the Royals that we know, and that's the scary part, because you don't want that to snowball. And if there's any, for whatever reason, it appears to be some sort of weird organizational paradigm that things like that do snowball for this organization, and they become this weight. It's, we talked about it when Mellinger was on the show. This is such a different organization than just about anywhere else, because it's not the pressure of this season or, you know, this manager or this GM. It's the pressure of an entire town.
It's a generation.
Yeah, exactly. An entire generation, 3 decades. And I mean, you can talk about Cleveland, you can talk about Seattle, you know, and they've had their problems and their issues and some poor teams. But, you know, Cleveland has made playoffs in a World Series. Seattle's made playoffs in a World Series. Well, I don't think they've made the World Series, but they made playoffs. And I can't remember when the last time they did. Maybe 2001 when they set that record for wins in a season. But regardless, you know, it's, The current generation remembers what it was like to see a successful team. Ours doesn't. Right. So it's this weird thing that just it becomes. That's what people talk about when the Royals dealing with pressure and stuff. It's not just normal, you know, professional sports pressure. It's a little bit different in this town. But we'll kind of go a little bit deeper and starts, Mike, we've kind of talked about some takeaways, but let's start with the positive scale. We'll do a compliment sandwich, if you will. We'll start with something positive, then we'll maybe go to something negative, and then maybe finish out with something positive. Maybe we'll keep going if we want. Who knows? But so give it to me. What is number one most positive takeaway from the Royals at the All-Star break this year?
Their starting pitching has been very good. You know, when you look at top to bottom, it's a team where, you know, Bruce Chen has started 5 games this season. Aaron Brooks has started 1, but otherwise you've pretty much got the 5 guys that you would want out of, you know, who's available for this team. James Shields is having a down year for him, but it's still a pretty good year for most.
Still a sub 4 ERA.
Yeah, it's 3.65, and he had a, you know, promising start against Tampa Bay to kind of finish a string of really bad starts. So that was good to see. Hopefully that portends, you know, future success. Jason Vargas has been really good, a lot better than advertised. This seems to be the perfect situation for him. He's got a great outfield defense, and he's a fly ball pitcher. He's got a ballpark that suppresses home runs, and he's a home run pitcher. And he's pitched better than probably even Dayton Moore had anticipated. So that is a fine number two guy. And then you look at the combination of Danny Duffy and Yordano Ventura, and they are doing exactly what you would hope they'd be able to do. Duffy's out there. He's been more consistent than he's been at any point in his career. He has shown a lot more efficiency when he goes out to the mound, and he's, you know, he's controlling his walks, and that's kind of the big thing that allows him to go deeper into games, which allows him to eat up innings, and he has more success. Ventura's been really good. He's had a couple of rough starts here and there, but for the most part, he looks unfazed by this level of competition. And then you look at the, you know, just consistency top to bottom. I mean, you've got the same guys pretty much every time out. The exception of that is Jason Vargas, who went on the DL with appendicitis. But the Royals really feel like he's only going to miss the one start that he missed. So if he comes back full strength, you go right back to where you started from. So that is the key strength of this team right now, is starting pitching. You've got 4 guys over 100 innings this year. You've got 3 guys over 120. So you're just chewing up those innings. I don't know if they're on pace, that puts them on pace for 1,000 innings from their rotation, which is always kind of Dayton Moore's pet project. But they're going to be close. They were really close last year. I think they came like 5 innings short last year. This year they're going to be really close again, it seems. And the bullpen's been good too. But I think the starting rotation is really what sets it up, because those guys are, you know, those are the guys who go out there 6-7 innings every night and, you know, become that bridge to the bullpen, so that if the Royals do get a lead in those first 7 innings, you can pretty much salt it away from there.
Indeed. And that was one of the things we were worried about. You know, there was the big saga of the offseason was Urban Santana. Is he staying? Is he going? Can the Royals afford him? Will they afford him? Well, it's a moot point. Doesn't matter. I mean, we lamented the Jason Vargas signing. It wasn't so much the Vargas signing as it was the Royals trumpeting it as a major baseball announcement, but we're not going to get into that argument.
Right.
Regardless of how big of an announcement it was or wasn't, it's worked out beautifully, and Dayton Moore deserves to get a ton of credit. You know, who? I mean, it's one of the things that people were hesitant about was that it's a 4-year contract. So we'll, you know, we'll see down the road. But as of right now, 2014, which is the main year, you know, as far as with James Shields and all these pieces still here. You know, right now it's working out great. Hopefully the appendicitis, appendectomy that he had doesn't affect too much, and he can come back and kind of regain that early season form, and or, you know, first half season form, because he never really lost it. But hopefully he can keep that going and have hopefully his best year ever, and maybe it'll snowball into a few more years. Who knows? but for me, I think the number one thing, number one positive thing in the first half of the season was the outfield. Mm-hmm. So if you look at, according to Fangraphs, of the top 5 players on the Royals in terms of WAR, wins above replacement, 3 of the top 4 are outfielders. And you've got Alex Gordon at 4.6 WAR, which is just phenomenal.
In a half.
I mean, that is MVP caliber numbers for a half season. And nobody nationally nobody is really talking about it, which on a side note is kind of funny because the Royals talk about how they have a better perception nationally than locally, but the only people trumpeting Alex Gordon as a legit MVP candidate are local. Anyway.
Right. Except for Keesman.
True.
Yeah.
And then you've got, and I mean, Alex Gordon does deserve some criticism because he's cooled off at the plate a lot. He had a 3-for-43 stretch.
Yep.
I mean, he needs to step it up offensively, especially because the Royals just plain need it because they need more runs, more offense. But yep. Then you've got the number three player on the team in WAR is Lorenzo Cain at 2.4, and he's having just a career year.
Yeah.
Great year. I mean, he's hitting 307, 342, 425, which is, I mean, it's better than Alex Gordon's numbers. Alex Gordon is hitting 268, 348, 425. So, you know, nearly identical on base and slugging and 40 points higher in the batting average, you know, and not as much power, and his defense isn't as good as Lorenzo Cain's defense is good. It's not as good as Alex Gordon's is in left field.
I would say that because he does it in center field, I would say his defense, he doesn't have the arm.
No.
For sure. But I think overall his range and his ability to read the ball, I would challenge you on that. I would say the relative value, I think he could probably be closer to Gordon in left than Gordon would be to him in center.
That's a fair argument. Sense. I mean, that's definitely an argument when you talk about the value of center field making Lorenzo Cain almost equal defensively because
it's higher on the defensive spectrum.
Yeah. So. And that was just kind of off the cuff me going by what FanGraphs says, but their defensive ratings has him rated lower than Alex Gordon. But to be honest, I'm not exactly sure how they put these together. So if it's rated against all left fielders, all outfielders, or how it's, I'm not sure.
But, yeah, it might be by position. I don't know. But I mean, Gordon, I mean, he does get a benefit of not just because he has a great arm, but because that arm, even when it's not put to use, has a lot of value. Because yes. I think Dave Cameron, or I don't remember who it was, if somebody on FanGraphs, they wrote a thing about how his arm is a deterrent and how you can measure bases that guys did not try to take because he was the guy with the ball who could throw them out, which is, you know, that saves a base. I mean, when you look at the run expectancy table that you can have, you know, Baseball Prospectus has one, Tom Tango has one, wherever you find it. I mean, a base runner at first versus a runner on second is a different situation, and there's a different run expectancy. So you can, you can put some value on that. So that's a big part of what Gordon brings. So that kind of bridges, that kind of evens it out a little bit between he and Cain. Whereas Cain is just exceptional in center field, but he doesn't have the arm. He's the weakest arm probably of the three best defensive outfielders out there.
Weaker than Dyson's, you think?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, they're close. They're close.
Dyson's I don't know if I'd go that far.
Arm, and it took some convincing and some watching for it for me because I didn't see it at first, but yeah, I think Dyson's maybe a tick better.
I mean, none of them have a bad arm.
No. None of them are Johnny Damon or or anything like that.
Or Nori Aoki even.
Right.
But I don't know. I don't know if I'm on board that train that Dyson would have. That's tough. I mean, it's not. No, neither of them are running away with it. But
right.
In terms of his better arm, but I mean, what Lorenzo Cain has done better in batting average this year. Gordon has done better, and even though their slugging percentages are equal, Gordon's power has been better. His ISO is quite a bit higher, which for those of you that don't know, ISO is basically just your slugging percentage with your batting average subtracted out.
Yep.
So that it actually takes into account everything you get, you know, beyond your just regular hit, you know, the actual power portion of it. Beyond just your singles, more or less.
You could also calculate it by total bases minus base hits and then divide that by at bats. It's the same thing. I mean,
there you go.
It just works out the same. It shows you relatively how many more extra bases they're getting per hit, basically, in a way. Kind of.
And that's about 40 points higher for Lorenzo, or for Alex Gordon than Lorenzo Cain.
Yep.
And base running too. So that ultimately that, so Alex Gordon's arm, his power, and his base running, those combine to push that WAR up quite a bit. But to finish out the outfield being the most impressive, Jerod Dyson is fourth on the team, believe it or not, with a 2.3 WAR. So, you know, and he's another guy with a high defensive value, and he's having a career year at the plate. You know, he's mm-hmm. hitting 293, 348, 340. Like, obviously the power is not there, and you wouldn't expect it to be, but, I mean, he's getting on base, and he's a threat when he's on there.
Yep.
He can he can steal bases as well, if not better, than anybody in the league. I believe he's leading the league in stolen bases. Is that right?
No, he's not.
Escobar is.
Yeah, Escobar's leading the Royals. But, I mean, Kane's right.
Or third in the league. I'm sorry. That's what I heard the other day.
Yeah, he's up there. And when you look at it from perspective of, you know, he's got 44 hits. He's walked 13 times. So that's 57 times on base. He's 18 of 22 stealing. So when he gets on, he's going. And so most of the time, even if it's a single, even if it's a walk, a lot of the time, that's a double. Because he's going to go, and he's usually going to make it.
Yeah.
So even though the slugging's not there, he's providing a ton of value. And when you look at it, Alex Gordon's played 88 games. Dyson's played 67. And
not all those are starts.
And not all of those are starts. I looked it up earlier today, and 40 of those games are starts. Most of those, he's coming in the 7th, 8th, 9th inning.
And literally 200 additional playoff appearances for Alex Gordon.
Yeah, it's remarkable, actually, to just kind of see. He should probably play more than Nori Aoki after the break. He's definitely earned it. He's a lot more in tune with, like, what this team wants to be. And his numbers are better. He's playing better than Aoki. So there's not a great case for Aoki to get more playing time than him. So, and, you know, Dyson's younger, and he's going to be under team control for longer, so they don't have a ton of incentive to play Aoki over him other than to justify the trade, which would be silly because, you know, it's Dyson. Dyson's a Royals type of player. He's speed, defense, scrappy. That's what it is. So, yeah.
And he and we talked about this just, you know, recently and over the years on our little email chains and everything, that this is the kind of thing that the Royals need. You need, especially if you want to get to you want to make a real big playoff push. You know, we've talked about optimism is not a strategy, but regardless of that fact, you need something optimistic to happen. So you need, you know, you look at the Cardinals, and we've talked about this a lot, where they have your Matt Adams of the world, your Pete Cosmos, your David Freezes, you know, those people that come up seemingly out of nowhere and just have really good years for the Cardinals, and they're not necessarily that great, but, you know, for whatever reason, they fit their mold. The Cardinals hit the right buttons with these players and they perform well. The Royals need that, and they're getting it from Jerod Dyson and, to a lesser extent, Lorenzo Cain. I say lesser extent because there's been some expectation that he would perform close to this level for most of his career so far, but, you know, the biggest problem why Jerod Dyson's more or less resurgence isn't really as big of a topic is because the Eric Hosmers, Billy Butlers, and Mike Moustakas of the world have got down the tubes, more or less. You know, those players need to be better in order for Jerod Dyson's play to actually help elevate the team, because right now it's just helping them stay afloat. And with that, I think we'll kind of drop into the negative portion. So, and it might be,
room for improvement.
Yes. That's what we call it. Areas
for improvement. These are not negatives. They're areas for improvement.
Areas for improvement.
I did evaluations at an old job for like 5 years. So
that is some HR training. Right,
these are areas for improvement. These are opportunities.
They're
for
even
improvement.
Better, even better. Opportunities. Well, lay it on me then. What are the opportunities for this Royals team to improve in the second half?
Well, it's like you said, Hosmer, Butler, and Moustakas. I mean, those are three guys that you felt like you would plug in. Hosmer at three, Butler at four, Moustakas at maybe even six. I don't, you know, wherever you wanted to fit him. and that you would get something out of them. And really what you've gotten some home runs from Moustakas. He's actually hit okay since he came back from Omaha, so I'll give him credit for that. He's second on the team in homers, but he's still not getting on base. And even if you, for a lineup like this, if you had guys like Hosmer performing like you expect and Butler performing like you expect and Gordon playing with more consistency, Infante's kind of had some slumps in him here and there too. If those guys are playing where you think they are, a guy like Moustakas, you can kind of handle it as long as he's giving you power and defense, but he hadn't been. So he's a big key. If he can continue to make progress and get somewhere, he's hitting 192 now. You know, I didn't calculate it out to what he would have to hit over X amount of plate appearances, but you know, if he can get into the 220s, 230s, I think that's maybe doable. Probably puts him somewhere around 20 homers, and that's going to be pretty important there. Hosmer and Butler have been just power starved all year. Hosmer's kind of starting to come around, where he's hitting some doubles again, and he's hit a couple homers, and he had a really, really bad start. Like June was really rough, and he finally seems to be coming out of it, and he looks better. Like, it's not just his numbers are better, he looks better. And so that's encouraging. Butler, we're going to talk a lot more about Butler later, but he had just a miserable April, and he's hit a lot better since, but there's still like no power there. He's, you know, 19 doubles, 3 home runs. He's on pace for, you know, maybe 7 homers at that, you know, so it's just not something that you can really stand from that. And they dropped him in the lineup a couple times. He's hitting 6th and I think even 7th. And had a day off in there just because he hadn't been producing. And so those are the guys, the biggest areas for improvement, because it's like you said, you're kind of just breaking even because you've gotten a pretty decent year from Alcides Escobar. You've got these great years from Dyson and Kane. Infante's, you know, he's leading the team in RBIs. So you have all these guys who are like your role players, but your stars aren't doing anything. And so, you know, it's almost like if those guys perform like they're supposed to, it's almost like you at the break picked up 3 new bats and plug them into your lineup. If they can take off and hit like Hosmer hit last year, like Butler hit in 2012 and in years before, like Moustakas has hit in stretches. You know, if you get that and everybody maintains, offense might take off a little bit. So that's the biggest area for improvement. And, you know, like I said earlier, if you can get those guys to hit, they get you a lead, you go to the 7th, 8th, 9th inning, well, you can pretty much put it away because the Royals have a great back end of the bullpen. And you're not worried about Wade Davis or Gray Holland or Kelvin Herrera or the new guy, Jason Frazier, who they picked up today. So they've got a lot of good arms in the bullpen. They just need guys to get a lead so that you can utilize those guys. And the keys are going to be Hosmer, Butler, and Moustakas.
Yeah, I don't know how much I can add to that because, I mean, anybody who has been following this organization knows that that's pretty much it. I mean, the Royals have one of the best staff ERAs in Major League Baseball. They have one of the best defenses, if not the best, probably arguably the best defense in Major League Baseball. And then, you know, all they have to do is put together the hitting. I mean, if I were to try and say something else, I think you could make an argument that the bullpen could be a little bit better, at least not necessarily that it was bad from the first half, but we're talking opportunities for improvement. I think the bullpen has a little there, especially from the left-hand side. I mean, they really have not had a dependable left-hand reliever that they can really go to, a loogie, if you will, to get those strong left-handers out. So, you know, hopefully that'll change in the second half. But so there's an opportunity for improvement. But, yeah. I mean, the big thing is the offense. I mean, that as we said it for a while here, that, or I guess the last couple of years, as goes Eric Hosmer, so goes this team. And that's basically how it goes, or how it's gone this season, because Hosmer was hot and everything was going great and the Royals were doing well. They were in first place, and then he's cooled off, and now here they are. You know, so I mean, if Eric Hosmer picks it up, then this Royals team could make some noise. I mean, it's kind of weird to try and place so much pressure on him, and it's not necessarily all him, but I do think he's a big piece of it, and he's a catalyst, and he's always in that, you know, 2-3-4 position in the batting lineup where he can make a big difference. And you know, if he's out there hitting doubles and hitting home runs, and then he's knocking guys in, he's getting on base, and he's making a difference for this team. But right now it's not happening. And in the second half, that needs to change if this team wants to make it to the playoffs.
Definitely true. And it's, you know, I kind of want to see them come out with, you know, if Dyson does play over Aoki, to put like Dyson and Kane ahead of Hosmer and get two really fast guys with Hosmer up there and see what happens and go from there. And they, you know, Kane hasn't really been a guy who walks, but Dyson's been pretty okay at taking walks and getting on base that way. So I think that could do something. So maybe that would help Hosmer too. I don't know. It's definitely possible, especially if, you know, you've got pitchers who are distracted by, you know, Jerod Dyson and given fastballs to try to keep him from getting too easy of a steal. So, but that's a whole other discussion of if that's even a valid thing. I would say so, but we yeah. I don't have any numbers to back it up. So that's just my intuition.
Indeed. And to finish with the top half of our compliment sandwich, I think the one thing we haven't talked about really that, I shouldn't say haven't highlighted specifically, is the overall defense. Not in this, you know, we talked about the outfield with Gordon, Kane, and Dyson, but just overall the defense. I mentioned that they were the, you know, more or less they're arguably the best defense in the league, and they kind of have been for the last year or two. So, I mean, I think that's one of the things. This Royals team has hung their hat on pitching and defense, and to their credit, you know, 2013 and now 2014, they have held true to that, and it hasn't disappointed. So many times in years past, the Royals as an organization have said, oh, you know, we're going to do this year, and we're going to be so much better, you know, fundamentally or on defense or whatever. And then Tony Peña Jr. is out there kicking balls off his, you know, everywhere, and nobody's doing anything that they said they were going to do. But this team said they're going to pitching and defense the way they were going to focus and, you know, improve the offense as much as they can. And it shows, you know, they have true to their word. This team, the pitching is great and the defense is great. And I mean, that's a lot of things. I got to think that's, especially with someone like Mike Moustakas. I mean, we've obviously seen the alternatives and they're not necessarily that great, but all the same, he was sent down to Omaha, came back pretty quick. And one of the reasons he can stick around with an awful 192 batting average, even beyond the golden calf syndrome the Royals seem to have with players like him, it's because of his defense. He plays very legitimately good defense at third base. And you have Alcides Escobar, who is one of the best shortstops on the planet and is probably an all-star this year, if not for Derek Jeter being his last season.
Oh, really? It's Derek. When did that happen? I didn't hear about
weird.
That.
I know, right? Someone told me that is the only reason I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dang. You'd think someone would talk about that more.
You would think, you know?
Yeah.
It's almost like they don't even care.
Yeah.
a little sarcasm there from the
just a touch, yeah, a little bit.
Baseball vault, you know. But anyway,
flyover state problems,
if you will.
Yeah.
Then you've got back on the defense, you know, you've got Eric Hosmer, Gold Glover at first base, who I think has gotten even better this year. He's seemingly stopped the big swipe that I never really had a huge problem with, but people just love to rail on.
I hate it. It's like this big Matador swipe, this big ole.
I just never understood that, like, people would be out there and I'm on my soapbox singing the long toss anthem and talking about on-base percentage and all this stuff, and you get so many people that dismiss all that stuff as nonsense and everything else. And Hosmer makes a big swipe when he digs out a ground ball, and all of a sudden everybody's, you know, Harmon Killebrew over here talking about stuff. So that's just, I never understood it. Not necessarily that I disagree with it. I just never understood why it was always
why big that people. That's the sticking point.
Yeah, that's the one thing that everyone can rail on. You know, it's just because ultimately it's because it's not the way they did it when they played in grade school or high school, whatever the hell that was. And, you know, they didn't have advanced stats back then and nobody cared on their baseball team. So that's why they don't care about advanced stats. But damn it, they never did big Matador swipes when they dug out a ground ball at first base. That's not fundamentally sound. But anyway, Hosmer, I mean, I think he's gotten even better this year. I mean, I cannot remember the last legit screw-up that Hosmer made. sometimes I get a little nervous that, and I feel like he takes too many balls where he could just make an easy toss to the pitcher.
Mm-hmm. And he tries to take it himself.
Sometimes it makes me a little nervous, but it hasn't come back to yet.
He's had a couple of those plays where he's going and has to dive for the bag. And he had like three of those in a week. It seems like that was his new goal or something, was to do one of those every game or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a little close, but.
Last year I was kind of like, okay, Hosmer, I'm not exactly sure where this reputation comes from. His defense is pretty good, but I wasn't wowed. But watching him this year, like, I've been very impressed. Like, I think he's gotten even better than he was last year. And I wouldn't be surprised if he wins another Gold Glove.
Not a lot of contenders.
Which helps. And then finally, of course, the crown jewel of the Royals right now, Salvador Perez, all-star starter Salvador Perez. So, I mean, it doesn't get any better when you're behind the plate. I mean, there's maybe three catchers in all of baseball that are as good as Salvador Perez. So, and defensively, you know, all around, probably still only three, but definitely only three defensively. I mean, I could probably say you have an argument for Yadier Molina.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got your Matt Wieters argument.
Yeah,
I don't know if you would argue Buster Posey all around. Yes,
maybe. Jonathan Lucroy is really, really good too.
That's true. That's true.
Yan Gomes is pretty good, but a lot of that is his arm. He's got really good arm.
Yeah. So I mean,
I would still lean Sal, and I don't think that's a hometown bias either.
No, I bet if you asked most GMs and scouts right now, and most quote unquote baseball experts, and people write about it all the time, rank the top five catchers, Salvador Perez is on every single list and probably in the top three on most. So that would be my guess. And I don't feel like I'm going out on a limb saying that at all.
Yep. Especially if they can take his contract. Cause that is just
good Lord. We have done a lot of ripping on Dayton Moore, but you know, there are areas where we've given him credit, and this is one of them. He deserves all the credit in the world for, first of all, finding Salvador Perez, which
I'm not 100% sure he was the key.
I mean, obviously, he's not going out there. It was because I've been informed that it was one of the holdovers from the Allard Baird era.
Yeah,
because
they signed him in 06.
The contact there and all that kind of stuff. So
they signed him while Moore was in office. But yeah,
so it wasn't necessarily Dayton Moore, but all the same,
still,
he was probably in a position to say, don't do this, I don't like this guy. But he didn't. So we won't necessarily give him a ton of credit, but you know, they found him. So we'll give the Royals credit for finding
him. Yeah, it very well may have been that he was in charge of a lot of that, because I tried to like dig up the signing scout to find more information on him. Couldn't find anything about him to see if he was part of Baird's or Dayton Moore's crew. So, I mean, I guess if you want to give it to Moore, I can't really refute in any way. So, you know, but still, I mean, they used him and they developed him, brought him up, and
regardless,
they were aggressive with him too. So they recognized when they felt he was ready and decided that, okay, it's time to make a move on this, and they haven't looked back yet. So
we're talking about a Gold Glove, two-time All-Star catcher who's not played more than, what, 2 weeks in AAA?
Right.
I mean, he was in AA, and people were like, oh, wow, maybe this guy's for real. And they move up to AAA, and the Royals get a couple injuries, and next thing you know, he's in the major leagues, and he never looks back.
Yeah, I mean, it was Trainer had that concussion.
Yep.
And then so they had Manny Pena up with Brian Pena, and then Brian Pena's wife had a child, and they had just had the paternity leave exemption for rosters, so they needed to bring up a catcher again, and so they brought up Perez. And so it just happened that these circumstances led to him debuting. Then they probably could have done it that time anyway, just because he was playing so well. But it is,
yeah, I mean, he was hitting.
It does make for a really good story for, you know, a guy who just kind of briefly stopped in Omaha and, you know, ended up, oh, now he's in the majors, and there you go. And picks off two guys in his major league debut and almost a third. So,
I mean, in total, this includes a rehab stint in 2012. He's played 24 games and he's had 102 plate appearances in AAA. And this guy's a two-time All-Star with a 297 career batting average and a Gold Glove and probably another one on the way and many more after this year. So,
and 11 home runs at the break.
What's that?
And 11 homers at the break. So yes, he's got a good shot to lead the team in homers too. So
yes, I mean, and he's another guy that, I mean, he's got a good reputation around the league, so he maybe should be talked about a little bit more as an MVP candidate. But I mean, if he ends up hitting, say he gets a little bit hotter and he gets 25 home runs this year and hits 285, 330, 450, and playing Gold Glove defense behind the plate, I mean, that makes him one of the top five most valuable players in the league. Has to. So
yeah,
just because of how valuable catcher is.
Yeah, and not just for that contribution, but when you consider the salary too.
Yeah, because we didn't even talk about that.
Crazy. He's in the second year
of a 5-year base contract that has three option years, and in total, if I remember the numbers correctly, 24 million, I believe, in total for the 8 years.
I think it started at like 19 million. He's going to get bonuses because they've got like 5 points if he wins, like All-Star selection, Gold Glove, MVP, maybe batting titles in there. I'm not sure what the conditions are, but they've got things that if he gets these and you get a point for each one and he gets five, then there's an extra like 5 million jumped in there. He's already got Gold Glove. He's going to get another one. He's got two All-Star selections.
Okay, I've got it pulled up. So, let's see. Signs a 5-year deal with the Royals for $7 million and then three club option years that total $19.75 million. So, the first 5 years, which he's in year two of this contract. No, this is year three, right? Let's see.
Signed it just before 2012.
Yes. So 2012 was year one, 2013 year two, and now we're in year three. So he's making $1.5 million this year, and then he'll make $1.75 million next year and $2 million next year. So he could be 27 years old, hitting 30 home runs, hitting 300 with Gold Glove defense, making $2 million when you've got people like, you know, Robbie Cano out in Seattle, who will be doing roughly the same thing, playing probably not as good defense, making $27 million or whatever he's making. So, I mean, this is just phenomenal. And then he's got three option years where he makes no more than $6 million in any of those option years. And those are club options.
Yeah.
So Salvador Perez is locked up for the next 5.5 years, the rest of this season, and then five more. And there's really nothing he can do about it. And actually, this is kind of an aside that we're on to here, but it's interesting. I actually had a conversation with Sam Mellinger about this on Twitter. Mellinger mentioned something about his contract, and I retweeted it. And someone asked a question to both of us, and, you know, about like that it's probably going to have to be adjusted because Perez will probably get disgruntled if he's doing really well and not getting paid. But I was like, there's really nothing he can do because, he signed the contract, obviously, and baseball, it's probably because of how different their union is and just the structure of the game itself, but baseball doesn't have holdouts like football does. And, I mean, really, football is just kind of its own animal because I don't really hear about holdouts in hockey or NBA either. But, I mean, this would be a really interesting situation because you basically have someone who, I mean, theoretically easily be worth $20 million if he continues on his current path, and he'll be making 1/10 of that.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's something where you could, I don't know what they could do. I don't know that I've ever seen that big of a disparity in a player. You know, unfortunately for Salvador Perez, there's nothing you can do about it. But, I mean, he's still getting millions of dollars, so it's not like he's out in the cold or anything.
Yeah, he's not hurting.
No, and he's going to hit just about every one of those incentives, and that's an extra $5 million. But and Mellinger had to convince me a little bit that there was – because I said there was a risk on both sides, because this was done after half a season in 2011, and, you know, even though not very much was guaranteed, you know, the Royals still could have theoretically been out this money. But that's from — that was me coming from a business standpoint, whereas, you know, any money that you spend that you don't get any return for is a risk. But in the context of baseball, you're talking $7 million over 5 years, then that's nothing. That's beer sales for, you know, a half a game or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
and so. In so many cases, you know, we talked about this probably last winter, where a lot of teams will do that. You know, they'll sign a contract kind of with the understanding that the last couple of years they're not going to get the value they probably should, but they expect to get the value on the front part of it. And so they're willing to take that big slice out, knowing that they, you know, even if it's the right value of contract, it might not be distributed evenly, you know, year by year. It's just going to be up front. And in this case, I don't know, there might be a good faith thing where they renegotiate with him. You know,
you'd almost have to.
Yeah, I could see how that might be a point of emphasis with some agents, especially if they approach asking about it. So if he asked and said, hey, I'd like to discuss this, and they refuse to, well, that's going to kind of – that could hurt them in other negotiations later. So I could see them doing that just because.
Yeah, I mean, it's – you could – if you're Salvador Perez's agent, which I'm not sure who his agent is. But
no, I would probably change agents.
Probably. But, I mean, at the same time, again, though, it was from his standpoint, you know – regardless of how much money it is relative to baseball, relative to everything, it's life-changing money.
Oh, yeah, and he got like $30,000 as his signing bonus and to come out of Venezuela when he was 16. I mean, that was...
Yeah, and I mean, this is after literally half a season when this was done.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a great half a season, but or not even half, 40 games.
2 months, yeah.
You know, so, I mean, it's from his standpoint, that you definitely saw why he signed it, you know, but...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're his agent, and whether it's the same one or not, if you're his agent and you're, you know, into year 4 and 5 where he's still only making $2 million, but, you know, worth 10 plus, maybe even 20, that's where there are ways, like you said, you know, it could hurt them if it gets public that Salvador Perez came to want to renegotiate because he's outperforming so much of his contract and the Royals just shut it down and said no. Yeah, I mean, that's a bad look. So there are some ways where you could have an agent that puts it out in the media, in the public. Royals refusing to negotiate. Salvador Perez is making, you know, is way outperforming his contract, and Royals won't recognize it. And, you know, they don't want that to get out too. So I'm sure that there will be – I bet they let it ride to year 5 because Salvador Perez is a pretty good guy. And then once they get to those option years, that's when I bet they're going to renegotiate and – you know, the only problem I see that could prevent and make this really ugly is the Royals just can't afford that $20 million contract range for anybody. So if they do agree to open up negotiations, that's probably going to be where it starts, assuming Perez, again, continues on the track that he's on. And the Royals can't afford it, but the Royals have the most leverage in that situation because even though it's a bad look, you know, they've still got the contract.
They've still got the guy till 2019.
And we don't want to get too into that now because that's way off in the future and it's not 2014, but that was kind of an interesting aside because that's definitely a big piece of this organization moving forward. And he just started in the All-Star game last night, so worth mentioning. But, all right, well, with that, I think we're going to take our first break. And then when we come back, we have a little something Mike and I have been preparing for you guys that we like to call the Ballad of Billy Butler. So please stay tuned, come back with us, and we're going to hit some country breakfast pretty hard when we get back from the break.
Come to Spit Cup this week. we'll let the person who has the highest bar tab ride the bull. We don't have any TVs in our bar, but we make our own entertainment. Mondays, it's free cover charge to anybody with a gun rack in their pickup truck. Tuesdays, we've got $8 beer night. All domestic beers are on special for only $8. It's Spit Cup. Wednesdays is longest tobacco spit. Thursdays is foot fungus night. Friday night is jamboree night. Bring your crap kick in your 10-gallon hats. And this weekend, you get our world-famous Spit Cup girls. You get to pick which one has the most teeth. It's Spit Cup. No love letters, talking to the wall. Or you could go to Kelly's Westport Inn. The highest quality drinks with the lowest prices. You know what we do. Drinks, friends, plenty of TV showing sports. They've got all the basketball and all the baseball on. Live music on the weekends. The best pizza in Kansas City and fun. Kelly's has the best rooftop patio in town and is voted one of the best places in Kansas City to check out the view, if you know what I mean, and maybe make a new friend. Make the best choice for your evening entertainment, Kelly's Westport Inn. Kelly's is at 500 Westport Road in Kansas City, Missouri. Kelly's Westport Inn. Don't forget, son, there is someone.
Welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Thanks for coming back with us. As we said over the break, we've got a little. We're going to talk a little Billy Butler in this second segment here. But before we do that, we have a special guest with us who, if you've listened to this show for quite some time, then you're well aware of the prodigal son himself, Troy Olson, has returned to his baby, the Kansas City Baseball Vault. Troy, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well, and I'm neither special nor much of a guest, so I guess neither of those really fit. But I was going to be silly after we decided you were going to host coming back in. I was going to just like talk over you, and in my head that was going to be really funny, but to everybody else it was going to come up as either really weird or a total asshole thing to do, so I decided not to do it. But in my head it was very funny.
We don't really,
a lot of things in my head are funny, so.
We don't really do humor on this show. We talk in monotones. About actuary table, no.
Statistical variations.
I think it would have been kind of funny.
It might have worked out. Who knows? But, you know, I will tell you, I listen to every show on the network now that I can't be on them, and I don't have to worry about editing them. I have more time to listen. I do listen to every show, and I'll tell you, getting Scobie twice on two shows in a month and a half was pretty fantastic because I can't ever get enough of Kevin. I think he does such a good job. And if folks haven't heard those two shows with Kevin Scobie, who's a bit of a pitching whiz kid. I mean, he could have pitched at the minor league level, but he decided to take his life in a different direction. He realized that he probably didn't have major league talent, so he went a different way. But, you know, he had a pitching school and some other things, and so he is a guy that has he can kind of claim to have been there. So if you haven't heard what he had to say about our current pitching situation, it's a must listen.
I like to get him going. It's fun.
Oh, it is. Always... And then you just let him go. And then you just let him go. Like, I think the last time that I was on an episode with him, we made a comment about his picture, and that got him fired up to begin with. And then I, like, asked one question, and that was 45 minutes worth of show.
It's kind of like what our first segment was. We just kind of went.
Yeah.
You know, I will have to say this. I do like the trade that was made today. You know, Pluto for a band of stars, that was a pretty good trade. So, and that's a joke that only the two of you get because it's from an yes. email conversation, but it's still funny to me.
But he doesn't listen to the show. So,
yeah, I like Jason Frazier. I like the Frazier trade. I think that's going to help us. And the funny thing is the guy was pitching for Omaha in the All-Star game today.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think
well,
was,
all right.
That was the Spencer Patton for Jason Frazier. Some people got worked up about that trade, and it really isn't that big of a, like, I get that, you know, Patton's got some really good strikeout numbers, but the guy's 26, and, you know, he's only got 40-some innings in AAA and hasn't advanced past that. And I think at a certain point, you know, you kind of have to fear that a guy's ceiling is pretty limited at that point. And maybe he won't be. He might go to Texas and break out, but... You know, the Royals right now, what they need is a guy like Jason Frazier, who they know is capable of coming in and giving them really good relief, set up the sixth, seventh inning and be that part of that bridge to get it to Wade Davis and then get it to Greg Holland. And they're in a situation where they can't really afford to have somebody learning on the job to do that. So I think it makes total sense. And it's, they're not going to regret trading Spencer Patton. He'll probably pitch in the big leagues for a few years and probably do okay. But I don't, it's not like they're, you know, you're not going to be seeing this in 10 years and being, oh man, can't believe they did that move. So.
Yeah. I mean, Spencer Patton isn't going to be around in 10 years. So that's definitely not something you're going to be worried about there. But, you know, I think it's just a trade that shows the Royals are still in on this year and they have to be. But it's definitely something you need to do. I was going to be smart, and I guess this morning there was a comment made on Kansas City Sports Radio that if you haven't heard of a prospect, you might as well trade him. Well, this trade's a perfect example of that. I'd never heard of the guy until you guys put him in an email. I'd never, ever heard of him. So maybe I'm not doing my job as a fan.
Yeah, and that's just dumb logic because there's – 5 years ago, nobody had heard of Salvador Perez, and I'm pretty sure we'd like to have him – still around. So
it's true.
Yeah, that logic is just absolutely without merit. But speaking of trades, one of the names that always seems to get pulled into all these trade rumors, whether it's off season, mid season, whatever, is the focus of fan lament, Billy Butler. And Mike and I have been kind of toying around with this, and we talk a lot about Billy Butler in our email chains because it's just such a lightning rod of a topic, because there's this weird dichotomy between the quote-unquote casual fans and the quote-unquote, you know, blogger community nerd fans, whatever you want to call us, basically, where the casual fan who just watches a few games here and there and doesn't necessarily dig into all the stats and everything, which is nothing wrong with that. I'm not trying to lament that portion of it, but to that fan, Billy Butler is, you know, useless, worthless, needs to be traded, not helping this team, you know. And I'm not talking about just this year, just basically throughout his career, that's what it's been, because he's only a DH. He doesn't look like a baseball player. He looks like he's overweight, even though I don't think that he is. You know, I think he's a pretty stout guy, but he looks too big. He's not fast. He's incredibly slow. He doesn't hit a ton of home runs, you know, so there's this weird, you know, kind of, I use the word dichotomy, but between that and then there's us who realize, okay, Billy Butler has been this team's best hitter for the last, you know, from 2009 to 2013, he was the team's best hitter. He had, from 2009 to 2011, those three seasons, I believe he had the most doubles in all of baseball, with, except for Robinson Cano. And then he won a Silver Slugger in 2012. He has led the team in RBIs and on-base percentage for, I think, five straight years he led the team.
He's been top three in runs scored pretty much every year since 2009.
Yeah, so, I mean, he has – there's a lot to like about Billy Butler, but you do have to dig for those things. And not very far, because those are pretty good stats and pretty impressive. But – it's not something that you can just tune into a random game on a Tuesday night and say to yourself, man, Billy Butler is a player. He's a, you know, unless it happens to be one of those really good games where he'll hit a home run or something. And you it just, when you look at him, it doesn't look like Alex Gordon, where you look at him and you say, man, he's really athletic. He's all over the place on defense. You can really see him helping this team. You know, you don't see that with Billy Butler. So we kind of dug up some stuff to try and get this ballad of Billy Butler, if you will. And Troy, feel free to jump in here, but we're going to start with Mike, and Mike's dug up some things, and then I've got some things that I'm going to add kind of piggyback off of what Mike said. But Mike, why don't you start us off as we try and encompass country breakfast in one segment, if we can.
Well, there's no denying that he's having a poor year. I mean, that's never been the argument that, oh, Billy Butler's having a fine enough year. No, I mean, we have to recognize that he's not having a very good year and that last year was a disappointing year as well. But relative to some of the other problems on the team, you know, Butler's still a pretty reasonable guy as far as a fixture in the lineup. So, I mean, I remember way back when in like 2006, 2007, where you would, you know, hear about Billy Butler in hushed tones, like, you know, the guy was drafted first round in 2004. He's 18. He goes, hits 373 in rookie ball. They jump him up to high A as a 19-year-old. He hits 25 home runs, hits 348. He's 19 years old. Goes to Wichita for a month, double A, hits 313, hits another, nine homers. You know, this guy is like a hitting prodigy at this point. And that's when he got lumped in along with Alex Gordon as like that, you know, before there was a first wave of prospects, they were the first wave of prospects. And so you get Billy Butler up in 2007 and struggled a little bit. And he comes in 2008 and he's, you know, does a little bit better. And he never really looked back. And you look at 2009, guy's 23 years old, hits 23 homers or 21 homers, 51 doubles. And at that point, it looked like sky's the limit. So that's kind of what you're looking at. 2009, he has a good year. 2010, he has a good year. 2011, a good year. 2012, you know, should have hit 30 homers. He went like a month without hitting a homer. But all-star year, silver slugger, 29 homers. And then, you know, last year, power kind of dwindled. This year, it's really fallen down. And so the idea is like, why? You know, what is this the real Billy Butler? Is he going to be able to bounce back? Are we going to see any flashes of 2012 or even 2011? So that's kind of what I looked at and what kind of things go into this decline. Because while the 29 homers was nice in 2012, Billy Butler's never been a home run guy. I mentioned the 25 homers in high A. Well, that was high desert in the California League, which is, I mean, the three of us could hit 20 homers almost in that league sometimes because it's just...
Maybe that's combined. Just,
yeah. Well, I mean, I could still put one out, I'm sure of it. Because that's just the league. That's the environment that you're hitting in. So, you know, I'm not going to really count that for him as home runs. Not to detract from it, but it's just he's always been a doubles guy. He's always been gap to gap. That's kind of what he's done. And I think that's what people see. They see him not hitting home runs with that kind of body type and expect him to be that barrel-chested softball league kind of home run masher. That's not what he does. He works the count. He's the most prepared of any Royals hitter. And that's what he takes up there. He's up there to not make an out. And if that means it's a walk, it's a walk. If that's a single, it's a single. If he can put one out, he puts one out. And that's kind of where this all starts. So that's kind of why I think there's a lot of loyalty still, because he's had a lot of years of sustained success. And even last year's numbers, you know, the power was down, but overall it wasn't too far off from what you would have projected. I looked at the Zips projections done by Dan Zimborski. They projected him at 295, 362, 476. He hit 289, 374, and 412. So the power was way down, but the other stuff was there. Baseball Prospectus projected him for just about the exact same. And, you know, he basically performed that with less power. And, you know, that's a problem. Don't get me wrong, especially with this team. But it's not enough to go ripping on him when you have guys like Eric Hosmer, who had just a miserable month, and Mike Moustakas, who was really bad. And in past years, players who weren't doing it. And that's where I think the battle lines get drawn, because you've got players who are not performing and people will obviously defend them no matter what. Billy Butler, who brings a little bit of a different approach and skill set and, you know, background, and people won't defend that for whatever reason, be it what he looks like, be it, you know, that this team just really needs the power and they expect him to be that guy. I don't know. But that's kind of where it starts off, is, you know, he has this long track record of success and now he's starting to fall down. So I'll let you guys respond to that. I do have some ideas on where that decline is coming from, but I want to hear from you guys too.
Well, let me jump in real quick. You know, my thing is this. Okay, Billy Butler, he's never made himself real available to the fan base, which is part of the reason that a lot of people don't like him. But it's just amazing how cold the fan base got on him after everybody was so high on him, high enough on him to boo Cano. I mean, something that really put Kansas City on the map, both in a good and bad way, depending on who you asked. And, you know, it's just, if you look at the DHs that Kansas City has had, yes, Butler is having a down year, and it's making it very hard for people like myself who think of him as a very good player and want to see him do well, of course, and have defended him in years past when people have been way wrong about him. You know, you look back through time, and, you know, you've had Jose Guillen, you've had Raul Ibanez, and then, of course, you had Mike Sweeney. But even look at Sweeney in his later, you know, in a lot of his years. Now, granted,
very
Butler's
similar
not in his
situations.
Later year, but... Yeah, I mean, very similar players. I mean, we can go back to having Mike Jacobs as DH if that's what people want, or I guess everybody wanted Rollo Ibanez there this year. Yeah, Keela, that's a good one, Mike. I didn't even
Clint Robinson.
Him.
Clint Robinson, yeah.
Oh, thinking of which, slight sidetrack here. I have an interview with Clint Robinson that someday, when I have more than 10 minutes of free time, I'm going to finalize and get up. So I do apologize. I have one of him, and I have one of the Ear Eater. And I'll get that one up as well. Miguel Olivo.
Former Royals.
Yeah. They were both, I talked to both of them preseason at here in Albuquerque because they were both playing for the Isotopes. And Clint actually got to the pros this year with the Dodgers for a while. I think he still is, in fact.
He just got outrighted to the minors yesterday. But yeah.
Okay. So side note there. But anyways, you know, Butler has definitely struggled and the proof is there. And so, you know, should Butler be traded? If you can get the right amount for him, this is probably the year to do it. But you would have to think that his value is at the lowest it can be. But I know Mike's going to give some more on why he might be lessening. But I just think he needs to get into a home run park. I think his game is too dependent on the home runs. And I'm not going to cop out to the K. You can't hit home runs in it. But it's a lot harder to hit home runs in the K than it is a lot of other parks. If Butler plays for Texas, or even if he played for somewhere like Arizona, he would be clubbing it, and it would be a whole different story. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I want to add on to that real quick, because if you put Butler in just about any other lineup that had some power around him where he wasn't expected to be the home run guy, his on-base stuff would come in handy, because now he gets on base. Good example of that is Sunday. He singled the lead off the inning. It took two more singles to get him the third and one more hit to get him to score. So, I mean, there's limitations to what he can do. But if you get him on base and the next guy can hit a home run, well, who cares how fast he is? He's just got to trot around. He's just got to make it. You know, who cares how long it takes him? Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I was just going to – I think that part of the problem with Billy Butler is two things, and it's perception and pressure. And to get into that, I think the perception part is – and Mike touched on this a little bit when he went over it, but the perception from the fans that have this distaste for Billy Butler is that he's not hitting for enough power. And I think part of that is not only because he's a DH, and you typically think of the DH position as a power hitter. That's why they're there, because if the only thing they're doing is hitting, they better bring something to the table besides just slapping singles around. And, you know, that's a reasonable expectation for the DH position. But I think more than that, too, is that there was this, I don't know exactly where it started, if it was the media, if it was the Royals trying to trump it up, but it almost seems like there was this unrealistic idea that Billy Butler was going to come up and be this masher hitting just, you know, 30, 40 home runs, breaking Balboni's record and all that kind of stuff. When, you know, if you go and if you were to read scouting reports and things like that, I mean, that's never really been the kind of hitter that he is, nor that he was ever projected to be. There was some home run power there, but I think the top end of that is that 29 home runs you're seeing in 2012. You know, he's more of a gap-to-gap, a double guy, and that's what he was supposed to be, and that's what he was for the first, you know, 4 or 5 years of his career. He's hitting, you know, 50 doubles a year, you know, more than the majority of everybody else in Major League Baseball, and driving in a lot of runs, leading the team in RBIs. But the home runs weren't there. And just people kept getting hung up on this home run thing. And then I think you had the tide kind of turned for the Royals as well, because the Royals were finally, nobody was hitting home runs. This, you know, after Jose Guillen and Mike Jacobs and them, I mean, those guys, as bad as those experiments were, you know, when they left, it just was bereft of power in this organization. And so I think the Royals just really wanted this home runs. And they had Mike Moustakas, they had Eric Hosmer coming up. And I think 2011 was the year they had all these young players that were coming through, and they needed Billy Butler to be more. And this is just, this isn't anything I've heard firsthand or anything like that, but this is just me knowing what I know about the Royals organization and kind of seeing, trying to put the pieces together. I think what happened is that the Royals just put an immense amount of pressure on Billy Butler to try and hit more home runs, right? Because like Mike said, his approach is a little bit different. It's a little bit harder for fans to get behind. That's why, I mean, if there's any player that, and he's much better than Billy Butler, but if there's a player that's similar, you might say Joey Votto, because as good as Joey Votto is, his fans seem to just hate him. I mean, this guy's an MVP of the league, and I guess I wouldn't go as far as to say they hate him, but the fans are just
they hate him.
Okay, they'll hate him. But I mean,
they hate Joe Mauer too in Minnesota. I get it,
which is weird.
I mean, it's because Joey Votto's hitting 17 to 20 home runs, but his on-base percentage is 450. You know, and no one realizes how valuable, or, and I wouldn't say no one, but a lot of the fans don't take a step back and look and realize how valuable that is versus, you know, Mark Trumbo, who has a 300 on-base percentage, but hits 30 home runs. You know, so, I mean, basically, those two players are, you know, equal, if not more so, in favor of Joey Votto, because he gets on base more and therefore creates more runs than just hitting a home run does. So that kind of an approach is hard to get behind. And then you mash this together with the Royals at this time wanting more home runs. And I was like, you know, it really seemed like 2011 was the year. So I went back and looked. And if you look at the first half of Billy Butler's season, that is, you know, before the All-Star break, he had only 6 home runs, right? So pretty similar to this year, not very much power. He hit 294, which, you know, pretty solid. Not a little bit, especially at the time, a little bit low for Butler, but, you know, good overall for baseball. And then he had 38 RBIs. He had 49 walks and 43 strikeouts. This is just in 89 games in the first half of 2011. So, to put that into perspective, the Royals have not had anyone in one season have 100 walks since Kevin Seitzer did it in 1989, I believe. So you're looking at Billy Butler being on pace to get to, you know, with a few other walks, you know, a little bit more than he did in the first half, to be that guy, to get 100 walks in a season. 49 at the break is phenomenal. And then only 43 strikeouts. So he literally, he walked more than he struck out, getting on base at a very good clip, to where he's helping out the team, even though he's not hitting only, even though he's only hitting 6 home runs. So then you look at the second half of the season, and he hit 13 home runs in only 70 games, which is a lot more impressive, which puts him on pace to closer to be what his 2012 was, along with 57 RBIs, but only 17 walks and 52 strikeouts. So you're looking at a 3-to-1 strikeout to walk ratio for someone who, over, you know, historically, he's got a 370 something on base percentage for his career. So then that kind of snowballed into the 2012 season, where he had his best year by far as a pro. He hits 313, 29 home runs. But you look again, he's got, in the first half of the year in 2012, he had 52 strikeouts to 29 walks. And the second half of the year, 59 strikeouts to 25 walks. So again, he's in that 2-to-1 strikeout to walk ratio, whereas previously in his career, he'd been much better than that. And then finally you get to last year where he had, I guess I won't say finally, because we'll talk about this year too, but last year where he had a down year, and that coincided with what? In the off season, we all remember before the 2013 season, what happened? They fired Kevin Seitzer and they bring in Jack Maloof and Andre David, and they say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to hit more home runs. We need more power in this organization. We're going to hit more home runs. That's what we want to do. We want to hit more home runs. Kevin Seitzer didn't want to do that. That's why we let him go. Jack Maloof and Andre David are the guys. They can make it happen. We're going to hit more home runs, right? So this is since 2011, basically, this pressure has been mounting in this organization to try and hit more home runs. And it happened that, you know, everything kind of worked out in 2012. But now you've got 2013 where they get off to a slow start offensively and the pressure continues to mount. And then Billy Butler, again, is in a situation where a lot of the pressure is falling on him as the DH, as the quote-unquote power guy, as the more or less elder statesman, to try and make this happen, to hit more home runs. And he had 102 strikeouts in 2013 and only 79 walks. So a little bit better, actually, than 2012, but still, you know, not to where he was accustomed to. And, you know, only hit 15 home runs.
Yeah.
Yep, only hit 15 home runs. So, you know, I think now we're – then, of course, it's all come crashing down this year where he's just having an awful season, like we've said. So if you ask me, I think that the problem lies in this perception that Billy Butler is supposed to be this big home run guy, but also in that there's been a lot of pressure on this from this organization for him to change who he is and what made him so successful. And I think a lot of that has mounted on his shoulders. And you can see the frustration on his face when he's out there in the, you know, and he hits a well-hit ball and maybe it goes to the warning track or something. You know, I mean, part of it is just the competitive nature of it. But I think part of it is that he knows he needs to do this. And there's a lot of pressure that this organization is putting on him. And I think it's had an adverse effect. And you can kind of look, you can track it and see that he's made these changes to try and do what the organization wants him to do. And he had a little success, but now it's starting to affect him adversely. And it might be too late now. Who knows if he can actually come back? So I think those are the two real big components that have amounted to Billy Butler being this kind of lightning rod for topics in this town.
So when you guys think DH, like the player that defines DH to you, who do you think of? Mike?
Edgar Martinez.
Jeff?
That's probably the one. Him or David Ortiz.
Okay, so that's actually where I figured you would go. I actually have both of those up right now. I would say Edgar as well. So,
oh yeah, easily. It's the easiest comp.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it's just they're both true DHs. That's what they did. They could play some first base, but they didn't. But the thing is, you know, you guys were talking about how the DH is supposed to hit home runs. Now, there are examples of DHs that do so. You know, Frank Thomas, who is also an excellent first baseman and a horrible human being, but that's a whole other story. And David Ortiz, who does crush on an average 35 homers a year. But then there's Edgar Martinez. Let's talk about Edgar for a second. First off, the guy never played 162 games, even though he never had to play in the field on a regular basis. For whatever reason, the most games he ever played in one season was 155, and he always played kind of around that, but sometimes way short. You know, he'd had a couple of years that he was hurt for the whole season. Billy has actually played nearly 162 games in all but three seasons, it looks like. Two seasons. His rookie campaign in his second year, he did 92 and 124. He's done 93 so far this year. But outside of that, he's had 159, 158, 159, 161, 162. So he's played in a lot. He's played on an average more games. But taking a 162 game average, Edgar Martinez, who is the epitome of DH, only averaged 24 home runs a year. Counting this year and last year, which have definitely been Butler's down years, he's averaged 18 a year on a 162 average. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of difference. That's six home runs. But I don't think of a 24 home run hitter as a home run hitter. I mean, didn't like Ozzie Smith hit 24 home runs a year with off the top of my head? I mean, nobody considered him a home run hitter, but
I think that was just on The Rookie with starring Brendan Fraser.
Maybe so, but it seems like if you think about it, there's a lot of players that you go, hey, that guy averages 24 home runs a year, and you don't think of him as a home run hitter.
And Martinez played in the steroid era.
Right. And that's an even bigger deal. And I mean, yeah, is Martinez a better player? Absolutely. That's not my argument. So please don't take this there. He hit 312, 418, 515 for an OPS of 933. Yeah. And he was like an OPS plus of 147. Yeah. You know, Butler's only had an OPS plus, including this year, of 119. If you could take out this year and last year, it'd be much higher, but you can't do that. That's not how baseball works. Nope. He's a 296, 361, 450 with an 811. So, yes, Eggers are a much better player. But my point is, everybody wants to get on Billy for not being a home run hitter. Nobody ever asked Edgar Martinez to hit home runs on a regular basis. Now, he had a year. He had a year where he hit 37. He played 153 games, hit 37 home runs. Billy Butler had a year where, you know, he was healthy and he hit 29. And like you said, he should have had 30, but it just didn't happen for whatever reason. I mean, Billy Butler was never going to be a home run hitter. And I think that whole thing with changing the philosophy just has ruined him. And like you said, Jeff, I don't know if he can get it back.
And the most important component of that, if you're talking about Edgar Martinez, is he had a guy named Ken Griffey Jr. on his team for a lot of years. And guys like Jay Buhner and others who were out there just crushing the ball and hitting all these home runs. So there wasn't, not only are you correct, Troy, in saying that nobody asked him to, but there was no pressure on him to do so because there were other people that stepped up and did it. You know, it's like all this, some of this pressure that should be on Eric Hosmer to hit more home runs is just people are just giving him the pass and pushing all that towards Billy Butler.
And I'm not saying that Edgar was juicing, but I find it quite interesting that his best year as far as a power hitter was at age 37. And he bookended that with his 36 year. He only hit 24 home runs. At 38, he hit 23. But at 37, he hit 37, which is the most home runs that he hit in his career. And then he had a couple seasons at 29. What I'm going to do real quick is I'm going to pull up what the 1995 Seattle roster looks like. He was an all-star that year. He had a pretty good year across the board.
I just pulled up. This is 1998 Seattle roster. Okay. Ken Griffey Jr. hit 56 home runs that year. Somebody named Alex Rodriguez hit 42 home runs. And then you had Edgar Martinez with his 29. Russ Davis had 20. David Segui had 19. Jay Buhner had 15. And Glenn Allen Hill had 12. Those are the top seven players. I mean, all those guys, that's going to take a lot of pressure off of someone like Edgar Martinez to be out there mashing home runs. 98 home runs just between Griffey Jr. and Rodriguez combined. I mean,
the Royals might not get there.
I would be surprised if they did, to be honest with you. And I mean, that's if Eric Hosmer was out there hitting 28 home runs and Alex Gordon was there hitting, you know, had 22 at the break for both of them, then no one would really care about Billy Butler not hitting that many. And he probably would be hitting a lot more because he'd have a little bit more protection and a little bit less pressure. So,
and in 1995, a 25-year-old Ken Griffey Jr. only hit 258. So he was just getting going that year. But they did have a fast guy by the name of Vince Coleman to help set the plate. To put pressure on pitchers to.
I don't remember him being any good though.
he hit 290, 335, 397. I mean,
okay,
he hit OPS 730 that year. He wasn't bad. What they did have is they had 31 home run output from Tino Martinez, 40 home run output from Jay Buhner, and then 29 from Edgar, 17 from Griffey, 23 from Mike Blowers. Who the heck was Blowers?
Mike Blowers.
I remember Mike Blowers, but not well.
I mean, and see, and those are just the kind of players that the Royals never seem to have, is they don't have these guys that, and I don't know what kind of a launching pad Seattle is, but they don't have a guy like, was it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, then that's why Mike Blowers hit 23 home runs. But, I mean, we can move off of this. I just think it's very funny how everybody wants to say, he's not a DH, he's not a good DH because he doesn't hit home runs. And it's so funny because if you ask people, who do you think of with DH, you're going to typically get one of two answers. David Ortiz, where the argument's a little harder to build, or Edgar Martinez, which is the one that makes the most sense because that's primarily what he was. And if you go Edgar Martinez, then it's every argument that we make for Billy Butler is what Edgar Martinez was. And it's what we wish Billy Butler was. We want Billy Butler to hit, you know, 30 points higher in batting average and OPS 100 points higher and have an OPS plus of 140 instead of 120. Absolutely. And he's not there right now. And we'll see if he gets it back at 28. You know, maybe he finds something that makes him get a little bit back. I'm not saying he'd be taking anything, but if he's taking something, might want to change it up.
Oh, geez. Just to be clear, the Kansas City Baseball Vault does not endorse steroids.
You know what?
So,
okay, the Kansas City Baseball Vault may not, but baseball was sure in hell a lot of fun when the steroids were going on.
They made a little bit of money.
Yeah, they did.
You know, I remember what really drew me back into baseball, and it will always be Sosa McGuire. That is absolutely what brought me back to baseball after the strike, because I was devastated. I'm a huge baseball fan. I go out there in tights and a cape, for God's sakes. I'm a huge baseball fan, and the strike devastated me. I remember it brought me to tears because I just didn't understand what was going to happen with baseball, and I didn't know what I was going to do with my summer because I loved watching baseball.
Now I have to watch the NBA.
You know, it was – yeah, and I mean, in Nebraska, you didn't get very many NBA games because you didn't really get Nuggets games, and there was nothing else close by for basketball, and we sure and hell didn't care about it at the college level. So I'm not even sure Nebraska had a – you know, I can't say that. They actually had an okay team in the 90s. You know, I was devastated by that, and there was some good baseball to be had in the steroid era, and I kind of think it's gotten a little blown out of, you know, now we got to see how they're going to fix it. Are they going to take the pad down and whatever else? And I'll get off this tangent, but they're going to have to do something to make hitting come back. And it's so funny because you take PEDs out to get rid of the mismatch of hitting and pitching, and now pitching's too strong because nobody's taken anything and they've all gotten weak again.
Well, let's answer the second kind of part of this question briefly here is, you know, is Butler going to be able to come back from this? Now, the first thing is, for his career, he's a second half hitter, which that can sometimes be a trap because, you know, it's always a different season. It's not like, okay, well, it's July now, I can go hit. But he has been over the course of his career. He's 286, 356, 421 in the first half of seasons and 309, 367, 486 in the second half. So that's some reason for optimism. But I'm just going to dampen that a touch because if you look at what his line drive percentage and his batting average on balls in play is, it doesn't look that great because his line drive percentage is actually higher this year than his career. It's 23.5% according to Fangraphs right now and 19.8% for his career. And 326 BABIP for his career, 320 this year. So normally you would expect the BABIP to be closer to his career range, which right now it is. You know, it's a regression, which we've talked about a month ago or so. So that doesn't look like he's got room to improve there. And if you look over some of his other hitting stats, his ground ball percentage after 2012 went from a range of about 45 to 48% up to 53-52% over the last each of the last 2 years, respectively. His fly ball range, you know, he was hitting fly balls up to 2011. He was hitting them 32, 34, 35, 36% of the time. Each of the last three seasons, his fly ball percentage has fallen, and you're usually going to have home runs from fly balls, which is kind of strange that 2012 is where this started because that was the year he had 29, but each successive year it's dropped to where now 24.6% of the time his at bat is a fly ball, which that's very low. And he's walking less frequently this year. He's striking out more often. So all that combined, plus the line drive percentage, batting average on balls in play, I'm not sure where the improvement's going to come from other than it just kind of happens and he gets it back.
And just to add to that, Mike, that you have Sam Mellinger started to mention this a little bit. He mentioned it in an article about Billy Butler, and then he's dropped it on Twitter that he's talked to multiple scouts here. And one of the things that they're saying is, more or less universally, it appears, is that his bat speed is down quite a bit this year, which was always a strength of his.
Yep. And that's where power that's comes
contributing.
From.
Yep. And that's contributing a lot to his downswing, his downturn. And some of this, not only did the scouts say that his bat speed is down, but that they're pessimistic about it possibly coming back.
Yeah. And this is it. The writing's on the wall that this is probably the last year Billy Butler is going to be with the Royals. They've got a $12.5 million option for next year. He's clearly not going to be worth that. They tried to shop him last year. Nothing came together. They've expressed interest in being more versatile at DH and being able to, you know, that gives you a chance to bring Sal Perez to DH, have a catcher, someone else play catcher, and you get the opportunity to get that bat in there and things like that, which a lot of teams are doing now. And that seems to be the way they're going to go after this season. So it does. It's pretty obvious he's not going to be back unless they renegotiate somehow. They're certainly not going to pick up that option. They're not going to give him a qualifying offer because the total would be higher than the option. So they would be able to trade him shortly after the season before they have to decide on that option, which is not very good because then you just really can't leverage it for any return. So they're either going to let him walk or they might look to trade him here. And Seattle's been interested, apparently. Jerry Krasnick reported that they have asked about Butler. I haven't heard anything about the second part of that and what the Royals might receive, but it's something that might actually happen. And we've talked amongst ourselves in the email thread with Dave Lesky and the three of us that it might be something where they look to trade Butler. And Jeff, you were fighting with Clint Scholes about this yesterday, too, and then trying to bring in somebody else to jump in where Butler was, who might be an improvement on Butler. So there might be some movement. I mean, I don't know. You've still got to come up with a deal, and I think the Royals will probably overvalue Butler for what he's done. And like Troy said, you'd be trading him at his lowest point right now. But it's pretty clear if they're willing to just drop him sixth and seventh when he really was hitting pretty well in June that, you know, there's something there where they just – aren't that interested, it seems, in protecting any legacy. They're pretty much willing to be like, all right, well, we're ready to move on. And it might be right. I mean, maybe the bat speed's gone. To watch him, it kind of seems that way. The power is so far gone. He's still hitting pretty well on balls of 90 miles per hour and faster, according to baseballsavant.com, which is a pretty cool site. But it just doesn't look like it's going to come back. And that's really tough to say because I've always been a really big Billy Butler supporter. But at the same time, you look at his body type, you know, it's very possible that that is something where the breakdown starts faster because he's just not in the, he's not in Alex Gordon shape. And, you know, there are going to be limitations in what you can do with that. I mean, so I'm skeptical that it's going to come back, but I'm hopeful that it will because it's still Billy Butler. And if you remember 2011, he really started to turn it on when they went to Boston. The Royals, first road trip, they're in Boston. So that's where Country Breakfast
was
born. So that's a good enough place to start it up again. So maybe he'll knock a few out and, revisit the Country Breakfast lore that you got him in the All-Star game and made him a fan favorite in the first place.
There it is.
Yep.
So to recap, you know, it's not exactly the most optimistic look, and it's kind of weird because we usually get the title of being the negative Nancy's pessimists of the Royals crowd as the blogger podcasters, but we're also usually the ones defending Butler. So we're kind of taking the opposite, but putting them together. I don't know. So it's a little bit more pessimistic than you might think given our typical defense of Billy Butler, but, you know, also just trying to provide some background to maybe make it so that it's not as, you know, it's not as easy for a lot of people to hate on Billy Butler because he has been a very valuable player and he deserves more respect than he's gotten from the fans and to be honest, more than he's gotten from this organization. But with that, I think we're gonna leave you this evening or this morning or this afternoon or whenever you're listening to the through the magic of podcasting.
And before you sign off, we want to remind them about the baseball reference promotion still going on. My subscription to the Play Index actually expired the other day, and I was able to plug in Royals in the discount code box, and it saved me $6 on another year of every single stat you could come up with. You can look
all at all of them,
pretty much everything. You can look at any split you can imagine. You can look at team and player individual games. You can look at events. You can, you know, if I want to look at every triple by Billy Butler, I can go find that. If I want to see what he's hitting against that day's pitcher, I can go find that. I mean, you just go plug in the information you're looking for. It'll filter it out. It's pretty much the coolest feature of a lot of baseball sites, and it allows you to really sift through decades and decades and decades of information with 2 seconds of searching. So it simplifies everything. If you're at all interested in baseball research and stats and even trivia and just weird trivia, like, I don't know, we've asked a couple weeks ago, you know, how many Maddux games did Greg Maddux actually throw? Still haven't gotten the answer on that from you guys. So you know, go to the Play Index, sign up with Royals, save $6. It's $30 for a whole year. It's less than $3 a month. I mean, if you're listening to us, I imagine this is going to be something you're going to enjoy using. So go ahead and use it. Go to baseballreference.com, go to the Play Index, sign up, plug in Royals, $30, boom, and then we can share trivia.
And I know Jeff does a really good job with this, but keep drinking at Kelly's, our longest sponsor. And with the direction the network's going, I don't know how much longer we'll have them, but you know, we do for now. And we appreciate those guys. And I tell you, there's a Kelly's Brew Pub here in Albuquerque, and I drive by it every day, and it makes me sad because I can't go home and I can't go to the bar I want to go to, which is Kelly's Bar in Kansas City. And the one here, I'm driving by it one night, and old people were freaking ballroom dancing inside. And I was like, I need some Kelly's Westport in, because this just isn't quite right. But keep supporting those guys. You know, obviously I've talked about, we held my reception there, which they had never done in the history of that bar. And them and Joe's, they're just fantastic people. And I don't get to brag on them enough on the air anymore. So go check them out. And also Out of the Park Baseball has their game for $20 right now on their website. It's the typical All-Star break discount. I'm hoping you'll listen to this in time to get that. That might be coming off though, so jump on it as soon as you can if you haven't already.
Indeed. I was just at Kelly's last Saturday. We had a little wedding barbecue shower thing for my fiance and I, and then afterwards we all went to Kelly's and had a great time. So definitely visit there and sign up for Baseball Reference Play Index, because it's a lot of fun. And you can, like Mike said, there's just all the stats you could imagine, boom, fingertips, just minutes, seconds, done. So with that, I think we will leave you on this wonderful evening as we record this, where the Royals have no game, as we wait the Royals playing their series in Boston. Hopefully Billy Butler gets back on track. Hopefully Eric Hosmer. Hopefully the Royals get back on track and they make a run at this thing in the second half. So thanks for coming in and listening. And for Michael Engel, myself, and of course, Troy Olson, this is the Kansas City Baseball Vault. And as always, go Royals.
Hey, that's my line.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.
Whoops.
Just reading me a little article about where David Price helps the most, none of which ends in the Royals.
That's too bad. It may have to remain a dream.
I dreamed a dream.
I just ripped a full page of notes. That's good.
Hopefully it wasn't notes used for this show, but
it was.
All right.
So there we go. We're off to a good start. 50 seconds. And
all right.
I've already ruined everything.
Well, that sounds about right.
God dang it. Surprised we made 50 seconds, actually.
To be honest with you, it's not a record for us. Oh, sorry. I'm so used to it. It just flows.
I actually was waiting for you to do that. I was all loaded with that one.